welcome to Skagit Talks. Interviews with interesting people from Skagit Valley College, as well as folks from around the Skagit Valley. Now, Skagit Talks. Welcome to Skagit Talks. In the first half of our program, KSVR presents the Skagit Valley News from around the Skagit Valley, as reported by Joanna Bruno. The second half of Skagit Talks will be our interview from the community and Skagit Valley College. Now, KSVR, Skagit Valley's community radio, presents the news.
Local farmers who want to sell their produce directly to the public can now download the Washington State Department of Agriculture's Small Farm and Direct Marketing Handbook. This new tool provides practical information about the resources available to farmers, how to operate a farm business, marketing strategies and regulations on specific products. Chapters include sections on licensing, food safety, organic certification, and marketing directly to consumers through farmers' markets, retailers and institutions, community-supported agriculture, farm stands, and UPIC. It also includes information on agri-culinary tourism and regulations affecting the marketing of specific products such as poultry and meats, eggs, fish and shellfish, fruits and vegetables, honey, milk, and dairy. The 125-page handbook can be downloaded at agr.wa.gov/marketing/small farm in its entirety by chapter or by topic. Washington State Department of Agriculture Director Dan Newhouse notes the information in the handbook makes it easier for businesses to navigate local, state, and federal rules to sell their goods, as well as capture a higher percentage of the retail food dollar. Helping farmers sell their produce and increase the economic viability of small farms is the core mission for our small farm and direct marketing program, Newhouse said. A lot of farm wisdom went into this handbook, and we paid special attention to summarizing pertinent rules and regulations in plain language. Childhood obesity is sweeping the country, but the Skagit County YMCA is ready to meet the challenge. A new program called Youth Fit has youth ages 9 to 12 playing scooter relay and dodgeball twice a week at the YMCA gym from 4 to 5 p.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. The Youth Fit program incorporates resistance training, endurance training, flexibility, and problem solving while participants engage in fun individual and team activities like obstacle courses, lifting weights, and playing creative games of tag. Youth Fit is a great way for kids to get exercise and make new friends, said fitness director Stephanie Ash. Childhood obesity is a major health problem, and lots of parents don't know how to get their kids more active, whether their child is obese or not. Youth Fit helps kids realize that being active and exercising can be fun. There are currently 17 youth who come to the YMCA twice per week for Youth Fit. Pre-registration is required to participate in Youth Fit. The current class ends March 4th. The next Youth Fit class starts April 6th. Call the Skagit County YMCA for more information. 40th District Senator Kevin Ranker is a supporter of Senate Bill 6350, which involves managing our marine environment. He feels that all of the uses of our coastline must be recognized before any new developments are implemented.
Typically, we've divided the way we look at our marine environment in Washington State between the Puget Sound, the Straits, and the open ocean coast. This bill kind of throws that out the window and says we've got to look at all of our marine resources. The auspices for this bill was a few years ago, there was a gentleman who proposed a wave energy development off of Westport, Washington. That was pretty exciting to promote these sorts of renewable energies that we could develop energy from waves coming into the beach. That process is permitted through FERC, which is a federal entity. It's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And as they were moving forward, this gentleman spent a lot of money moving forward on his development. It wasn't until the 11th hour that the fishermen stood up and said, wait a second, that's some of the best juvenile crab habitat in the area. We can't put a bunch of buoys there and close it down. And what this did for me was it really underscored a concern that has been being discussed at the federal level and that I've been paying attention to for quite some time, which is there is an increased demand on our oceans and our coasts and our sound. There's the typical uses, vessel traffic lanes, fishing, conservation areas, recreation, all these different uses in our oceans and our marine environment. And then there's all of these new uses coming in, tidal energy, wave energy, offshore wind development, new technologies for research and such. And so there's this just plethora of uses being looked at in the same areas. And so what this bill does is it implements over Washington's, all of our marine waters, a new management strategy that is spatially based. So it says, here's the best areas to do this. Here's the best areas to do this. And it starts by recognizing the importance of many of our existing uses. So recognizing the importance of fishing areas, recognizing the importance of recreational areas, recognizing the importance of commerce traffic lanes for our ports and such.
Once sensitive areas are recognized, decisions can be made about what areas can accept new uses.
And then it starts to identify, okay, and with those in mind, here's the areas where we may be able to look at for these new energy developments or whatever the next new technology is. So it's really getting us ahead of the curve. It's a big eye glaze, dense bill. I've had colleagues asking me, what in the heck does this thing say? I've read it 3 times and I don't have a clue. So it's really difficult legislation because I have to educate a lot of people with regard to what we're talking about.
Although the bill is complicated, Ranker feels its importance to our state requires the legislature to move quickly to implement it.
The other reason why I'm actually doing it this year at this time in such a short session, dire economic straits and so on, is because there is significant momentum right now on what is called marine spatial planning at the federal level. Barack Obama, our president, will be dropping an executive order in late March, early April, somewhere around there, on exactly this issue. So this is being defined right now by the feds, and they are looking to examples from regional areas such as ours. And so Bill Ruckelshaus, who opened the testimony of my hearing this week regarding this bill, said it very clearly. He said, well, we can either be at the table or on the plate, but this is moving. So if you have concerns with it, you know, let's work those out. But the reality is this idea of spatially planning our marine waters is happening. The feds are moving on it. And I personally, Senator Ranker, I would rather see us define what that looks like, protecting our critical natural and economic resources, than have that handed to us by somebody else. I think Washingtonians have a great respect and appreciation and love for our marine environment. And so this is a way for us to manage that situation better.
Ranker explained that this bill will affect all marine waters, including Puget Sound.
It's all marine waters, including the Columbia Estuary. So starting in southwest Washington at the Columbia Basin there, coming up the coast, all of the Straits of Juan de Fuca, and then coming all the way down to Puget Sound to where we are today here in Olympia. And so it affects Skagit County. It affects the 40th District. And one of the ways it will affect us positively is in Anacortes and in other areas in Skagit County and throughout the 40th District, we have very important, very critical jobs tied to the marine environment. We have fishermen, we have working waterfronts, we have ports. This bill looks at the importance of those industries and those jobs and frankly protects them. It moves us into a way where we can balance new uses with existing uses. So it's a very important bill for the Skagit.
Like most programs of this type, a great deal of preparation must take place before the plan can be fully implemented.
Skagit County has a Shoreline Master Program, and that is the county law that dictates what you do within the shore zone, which is goes, you know, a couple hundred yards out into the marine system and a couple hundred yards up, depending on who you're talking to and which lawsuit you want to read that day. So the county has a Shoreline Master Program. Above that, the state has a Shoreline Management Act. And above that is the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act. And so the Coastal Zone Management Act on the federal level requires that the state and the state requires that the counties and cities as well all be consistent with that federal act. So they all have some similar rules and regulations in place. And so the discussion of the CZM process in the bill is that the Department of Ecology has been, since the creation of the Coastal Zone Management Act at the federal level, each state needs to have a lead entity responsible for those actions. So to our Department of Ecology in Washington State is the lead entity for the federal consistency. And so we see an incredible opportunity with this bill to not just get ahead of this executive order that's coming down, but the Coastal Zone Management Act is likely to be reauthorized in 2011 at the federal level. If we are able to position these changes that we desire and that we're working on locally as being under the Coastal Zone Management Act authority through Department of Ecology, we will be positioned to make sure that our state and these new planning mechanisms that we're putting in place are part of that federal discussion. So it's about being consistent, but it's also about being proactive. This will be an ongoing process. There are requirements that the agencies come back to the legislature with recommendations and that a lot of the planning efforts. So the first part of this bill will be that all of the agencies need to go out and frankly map the existing uses, identify some of those that maybe aren't as clearly identified, and make sure that we have the data, because no planning process is worth anything if the data that it's based upon isn't worth anything. So the first year, those deadlines that you see in the bill are regarding pulling together that initial information.
All state agencies with interest in shoreline management will be invited to join the committee to administer this program.
I don't imagine we will be able to, say, launch the spatially planned management strategy for our coasts in a year. I think it's going to take some time, but we have to commit to it now. This bill cannot say that we're going to go halfway on this. We need to fully commit to it now if we are going to position ourselves at the federal level and also for potential federal support as well as private sector support. There's no fiscal note in this bill right now. What we are looking for is outside support to help us do this, and we hope that by letting the federal folks and the private sector know that we're serious about this, that they may be willing to help us get to where we commit to being.
For Ranker, the coordinating of all agencies dealing with coastal waters is vital to the future of our state and county.
The governor is her appointee, will chair it, but it's all of the state agencies that have any effect or input on marine issues. So that's everybody from the Department of Commerce to Department of Ecology to Fish and Wildlife to Department of Natural Resources and, of course, the Puget Sound Partnership in the Puget Sound. So all of those agencies will be on this team working together on this. Another thing that this bill does, and that team really will help push forward, is that currently, unfortunately, most agencies don't even talk to one another. And also, not only do the state agencies not talk to one another on these sorts of management strategies, but the silos that we put them in with our laws talk about one species or one habitat or one issue or one piece of economic development. And what this bill does is holistically say, if you're operating in the marine environment, you're going to be part of this team and you're going to work together. So it will also, in the future, make it much more realistic for folks who are interested in these issues to get a better lay of the land and maybe one answer and one-stop shopping on some of these things instead of having to go to 15 different agencies talking about 15 different things with 10 different messages.
Including the tribes in our state in this process is vital to the success of the program.
I would just say on that coordination piece that the tribes are very important to us. We've been working very closely with them, and their authority is something that is bigger than this bill, you know, and not to be questioned. And so as we're moving forward, we're going to need to continue to make sure that we're in lockstep with the tribes and working together, and then also working with our federal partners and counties and cities. So what it really does is it brings everybody together, but the authority is only with the state agencies.
This is Joanna Bruno for KSVR News for Skagit Valley. Thanks for listening to 91.7 FM. Please stay tuned for another Skagit Talks interview.
Welcome to Skagit Talks. I'm Dave McConnell, your host today. Recently, I walked into the Cedro Woolley Library to return some books. I stopped because I was confused because the counter where I normally return the books was covered with a variety of cooking equipment and supplies. I found a place to return my books and hung around to see what happened. It turned out that my guest today, Mary Anderson, was doing a cooking demonstration. Mary, welcome to Skagit Talks.
Thank you very much.
Mary, your title at the library is Library Clerk. That doesn't seem to me to include cooking demonstrations. What did I stumble into that day?
Well, actually, we were trying to initiate some adult book talks. And so what we were doing was not just a cooking demonstration. It was actually talking about books in which cooking is a main ingredient, as it were. We have plenty of cookbooks at the library, but what this was referring to and what we were trying to demonstrate that day and in the event since then was that there are a lot of books that talk about cooking or actually have recipes in them. And last spring, I guess it was, maybe it was earlier, Kathy and Deborah, the library, children's librarian and the head librarian, came to me and said, "We're starting to do some book talks for adults." We started with 3 cups of tea in May. And they said, "This year at the library, as you can see by the T-shirt that I'm wearing, it's Get Creative at Your Local Library for the Children's Program. And we were wondering if you would be willing to do something along those lines to incorporate for adults." And I said, "Oh, gee, like, what did you have in mind?" And so they talked about maybe doing some books. I have been cooking for many, many years, and I love to cook and bake. And frequently when these books will come out, say, for instance, by Joanne Fluke, she writes a mystery series about a woman who runs a bakery. And throughout the book are sprinkled recipes of cookies and things that she makes. And frequently I'm so inspired by these books that I go home and I make the recipe, or I change it somewhat a little bit, and then I bring it in for the library staff to sample. So they're constantly complaining about the fact that I'm bringing in goodies for them because they're all trying to lose weight. But they said, "This is what we would like you to do. You're always cooking from these books. Would you be willing to cook from the books in front of our adult audience?" And I'd said, "I'd be delighted and thrilled." So we put together a couple of programs, and that you stumbled across the first one.
And what kind of stuff were you making? What kind of things do you do? It doesn't seem like the library has the kind of facilities for cooking.
It doesn't, and we had to go through quite leap several tall buildings in a single bound in order for that to happen. It wasn't actually technically allowed by the health department, so I went down and got my food handler's permit, which, I did get 100% on that test. And then we investigated a couple of other places. We investigated the community center. We investigated the senior center. We thought about maybe doing it somewhere else. But, you know, when you're doing a book talk, the best place to have it is at the library, because that's your audience. That's where they're going to be in the first place, and you can capture them if you're program is exciting enough. So I said I would be happy to try doing it there. We do have running water in the back. And so I had a dishwasher who was ferrying back and forth with the dirty dishes. And then I just put together several different kinds of dishes. The first one, I think, was main dishes and desserts. And the second one was breads and main dishes. And the first one was hors d'oeuvres and desserts for the first one and main dishes and breads for the second one.
And how many things do you prepare in a session like that? How long does it last? Who comes?
Well, you know, we were only planning on a 2-hour event from 6 to 8. But, you know, food preparation takes time. And, of course, I wasn't just doing the food. I was also talking about all the wonderful books that these recipes were coming from and places that I was pulling other ingredients from. And we try to do as local show as possible, so I was using things from the farmer's market and talking about that as well. And so it actually ended up being about 3 hours long, and I ended up making 8 sets of hors d'oeuvres and several desserts, 2 desserts, I think. So it was quite a production. It took longer than we thought, but everybody seemed to have a good time. And although I wasn't technically allowed to offer the food to the public because it hadn't been prepared in a proper facility, I did tell them that if I would turn my back and if the food disappeared, I would not be offended.
And you were not offended because the food disappeared.
It did, yes. Gratifyingly.
And I was there for that first one, and nobody left, even though it did run well beyond the normal closing hours for the library.
Yes.
I think somebody scurried around and locked the door at the proper time.
But I think they did. I wasn't really aware of it, but I know that a lot of people were captured and stayed.
Yeah. How did you publicize this? How did people find out about it? I just sort of stumbled onto it.
Oh, well, as I say, because it wasn't technically allowed by the health department, being a non-approved facility, we didn't really advertise it very much. We just did mostly word of mouth to see what kind of response we would get. And we were surprised to get as many as 20 people the first time and 25 the second time. So it was really pretty exciting for us because that's quite a large adult turnout for an adult program.
Well, everybody likes to eat.
I guess they do, yes.
You mentioned one author. What other authors do you look for? Where did you find these? Are these books that you normally read?
Yes, these are books that I normally read. They're sprinkled throughout mostly our mystery section, but there are also books in our fiction section as well. We tried to stay away from nonfiction because we didn't want people to think we were just cooking from cookbooks per se. But Karen McInerney, Joanne Fluke, Nancy Fairbanks, there are a lot of authors out there who, in one way or another, incorporate cooking into their mysteries and into their stories. So Janet Ivanovich is constantly talking about Stephanie Plum and her love for pizza. So in the last one, we made a pizza, and that was really fun.
You even mentioned, but you obviously love cooking. Where did that come from? How'd you get started on that?
You know, I can't remember a time when I wasn't cooking. My parents got me my first Easy Bake Oven when I was 3 years old, and I started from there. And I was always at my mother's elbow in the kitchen. We had a nice large kitchen, and she was constantly cooking. She was kind of almost an earth mother type of woman. She loved to feed people. She loved to nurture and cherish people and take care of them. And so we were entertaining frequently as I was growing up. And I learned so many things at her elbow. And then I started becoming involved in cooking myself. I gave my first dinner party when I was 12, and I started reading Julia Child, and I learned from Julia Child how to make souffles and how to make gravy and how to make French bread, and I really started doing that when I was 14. You know, she talks so movingly about mushrooms, and I hated mushrooms as a child, and I thought, I really have to get over this, so I forced myself to learn to like mushrooms. Of course, now I love them. So Julia Child, much as in the film Julie and Julia, and the book Julie and Julia, which we also have at the Cedar Woolley Public Library, and which will be one of our book talks coming up here in the future, she's right on the money when she says that reading Julia Child is a course in how to cook. So I got the love from my mother and the joy from Julia Child, and then I just kept going.
At 12, I usually think of girls at that age, their first dinner party is a tea party for their friends. You had, sound like yours was more than a tea party.
Yeah, I was making crepes by then. I'd learned again from Julia Child how to make crepes. And so I was making crepes and filling them with savory fillings, like a creamy chicken filling or a spinach onion type filling with cheese. And so that was the first thing that I made for other people.
And your mother was obviously loved to cook as well.
Yes, she did. She was... when I was growing up in school, she was one of the helpers in the school cafeteria, and she applied for a position in a new school that they were building down the road from where we were, not the school that I went to, but another school they were building, and she did not get that job, and she was very disappointed about that. And a friend said to her, "Why are you disappointed? You're crying over a VW Volkswagen when around the corner is going to come a Cadillac your way." And shortly thereafter, when I was about 10, Pepperdine University decided to build a campus out in Malibu, which was where we were living. We moved there before it became Malibu, the famous place. It was where you went when you wanted good weather and not too expensive property. So we were living in Malibu, and my dad was working at Hughes Research Labs up on the hill, and Pepperdine was just right below there. And she applied for a job, and she got the job there. And she eventually became their head pastry chef. And Alice was so much a part of the institution at Pepperdine that food services would come and go. And then but the president of the university would always say to the new incoming food service, "I don't care who you hire or fire, but you have to keep Alice on because she's part of Pepperdine." And so the new food service would come in and be all hostile towards this woman. Who does she think she is, you know? And then within about a day, they would all fall in love with her because she was so loving and she was so intelligent and she was so funny and she was such a good cook. And so all the students grew to know and love her as Alice. And so she would often bring students home with her if they were alone or lonely or what have you, and she befriended many students over the course of time. So ultimately what happened was, well, she retired after about 15 years there, but while she was still working there, she was approached by the president of Pepperdine University, that President Gerald Ford, ex-president Gerald Ford, but they still call him president, was going to be coming to Pepperdine University and giving a talk. And so they were going to host a brunch for him. And he wanted her to prepare her sausage quiche for him, which he was very fond of. And she said, well, where do I do it? And he said, you can't do it here at the university because the head chef will be very offended if we give something else out to someone that he doesn't do. So he said, we're going to tell him that we're doing outside catering for the quiches and you're going to go home and do them at home. And she said, well, I could do that, sure. So one day I came home from school. I can't remember if I was in high school or whether I was must have been high school or early college. I came home, and there was my mother in the kitchen, in our kitchen, with these two men in suits. And then my dad was there, too. And I said, what's going on? And she said, oh, I'm making these quiches for President Ford's visit. And I was, oh, that's exciting. Well, the two men in suits were actually Secret Service men who still guard the president even after he's left office, and they were making sure that she wasn't going to poison him. And she, I remember, she turned to them and she said, well, you're two able-bodied men, she said, and I've got a lot of work to do, because she was making like 20 quiches, which is a lot of quiches. She said, so you wash your hands and you're going to grate the cheese, and you wash your hands over here and you're going to chop the parsley. And so she put them, or maybe it was the onions, I can't remember, but she put them to work. So these Secret Service guys are busy grating cheese and doing this. And then they worked all night, I believe. And the next morning at about 5 a.m, she and the Secret Service men all went to various households. She had requested several neighbors to leave their doors open and their ovens on. So she went around, and she baked off all these quiches in all these different homes, trailed by the Secret Service men to make sure she didn't do anything wrong. And then they went around after the first one was about ready, so they went around and picked them up and then drove them all to Pepperdine University, where we don't know if Gerald Ford himself actually ate any, but after that, she decided to rename it her president's quiche. And that was, in fact, it wasn't her quiche that I made, but I did make a quiche for one of the book talks at the library.
I remember that, yes. I don't remember what it was either exactly, except that it was good.
It was an artichoke. Yes. It was artichoke. It was an artichoke. Yes. I have an artichoke dip, and I worked it into a quiche. And I've actually heard from people that attended that they took the recipe home and made it for other people quite successfully. So that
good.
Was a happy event.
We're about out of time, so I've got one final question. Are you going to be doing this again at the Cedral Lilly Library, and when?
I am, and it's not quite clear. I hope to do 4 more this upcoming year, and we'll probably do them seasonally. So we might do something around Valentine's Day, and then again in maybe late spring or early summer, as long as the produce starts happening, and then probably again in late summer, and then maybe again next winter.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, thank you so much, Dave. It was a pleasure.
I've been talking with Mary Anderson, library clerk at the Cedral Woolley Library, cooking guru and mother. Mary, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
This is Dave McConnell signing off for Skagit Talks and looking forward to my next dining experience at the Cedral Woolley Library.
Skagit Talks was produced by Joseph C. McGuire and engineered by Jay Charles. Tune in next time for more Skagit Talks.